Next on queue is Steven Dunneman from the Samba team working at Isilon. And he's going to tell us something about Samba's new improvements to take advantage of One of S. Go ahead.
Okay, can everyone hear me all right? So I work for Isilon Systems, which is a clustered NAS vendor. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about our product first to get an idea of what it is, how it works, and how we use Samba in it. And then I'm also a member of the Samba team. It seems like we've been doing questions as we go, so we can just keep with that. Go ahead, raise your hand anytime. And we'll go on. I also hear there's a lot of other NAS vendors here, so I might have to crack some jokes about them. So what is OneFS? It's a file system, but OneFS is kind of our generic name for our operating system as well, because Isilon sells boxes. We sell hardware. We're a software company that sells hardware, basically. OneFS is originally based off the FreeBSD operating system, and our clustered file system that does all the magic under the covers is built into the FreeBSD kernel as a kernel module. We've done a lot of work on stock FreeBSD, though, in our IFS, Isilon file system, to add a lot of Windows-style semantics, as well as POSIX. So we got the POSIX for free with FreeBSD, but we've had a lot of syscalls that are very Windows-like, very Win32 API-like, because we need to provide the Windows experience to Windows clients and the Unix experience to the Unix clients. It is a clustered file system. That's what makes it special. Super simple way to think about OneFS is you've got RAID, where you've got lots of disks, and you've got a single file system striped across all the disks. Take that concept one layer higher and stripe a single file system across multiple machines. So you can have machine failures that don't affect your read and writeability of your data. And then another cool thing about OneFS is it's a single volume that expands across the entire cluster. So next slide. The theoretical maximum for a OneFS cluster right now is 3.45 petabytes. We've got a cluster in our data center at Isilon in Seattle that's like 700 terabytes right now, all in a single file system. So you can mount that over SIFS, and you've got your Z drive, and it's 700 terabytes. So these are what our nodes look like. It is commodity hardware. What's different about our cluster that a lot of clustered people understand the idea of a cluster. What's different is it's all together. There's no SAN backend. Everything, the CPU, the memory, the disks, between 12 and 36 disks are in a single node. And you attach three of those nodes together over a very fast backend. We use InfiniBand, and then that gives you the cluster, the storage, the processing, all together. We run Samba, SMBD daemons on each one of these nodes separately. And then a client can connect to any node. Each node has its own front-end interface with a different IP address. Clients connect to each one and read and write data to the global file system. And then cluster size, we can go up to 96 plus nodes, which is where we get this 3.5 petabytes. I think our largest cluster our largest node has 36 terabytes, and then you multiply that by 96, and that's where we get the 3.4 petabytes. So, neat marketing animation. We took the file system, the RAID, the volume manager, and it's all handled by software. It's just commodity hardware. We don't use RAID controllers even. It's all handled by a OneFS file system to have single volume. Some neat things about OneFS you don't get with other systems. Again, the single pool of storage. You're not buying 36 terabytes and then buying another 36 terabytes and having two, you know, a Z and an X drive. It's all one shared pool. We've got really granular data protection. On the per file level, you can specify the amount of FEC, forward error correction, ECC. That means the number of nodes in your cluster that can go offline and you can still maintain full read-write access to all of your data. So you can set 8x, up to 8x mirroring on any file, any directory of files, or you can set up to plus 4 recovery. So that's when, you know, up to 4 nodes in the system can go down. A hard drive failure in one node would be considered that node also kind of going down.
So when one disk dies, you'll take down the whole node?
No, but if that one disk held the part of the Stripe data for a singular file, then that would count towards the plus 4.
Okay.
Yeah, of that file. Then that file would be down to plus 3. Works like magic. In fact, that's one of the cute tricks our SEs like to pull is do a streaming video from the cluster and then start pulling hard drives out right and left. It's all handled. The data's auto recovered in the background. The data's auto balanced to keep all the drives at the same usage. So yeah, drives come and go, and your data's still there. Obviously, the penalty is that you're using up a lot more raw disk space when you're getting all this protection. So the other really great thing about Isilon 1FS is it's really super easy to manage as a data center admin. If you need more storage, you take a big node out of a box, you put in the screws, you plug it in the back end. We got a little front end LCD that says, you know, add to cluster, and then boom, your cluster's 36 terabytes bigger, and your volume just expanded. And then with the cluster access, it's very good for concurrent performance. If you've got a lot of clients all accessing this file system, you can have, you know, 50 clients on each node in your system, and then you've got plenty of CPU and memory for each of those clients. So that's 1FS. How about Samba? Inside of it. We have been using Samba for over 6 years now, starting from version 2.2 up to our next release will contain actually pre-release code from the 3.4 branch. So we'll actually be running 3.4 code before Samba 3.4 is released. We've had three large code merges up to this date. With the last one being done by myself and Tim Prouty, Tim? Tim's right there. Tim's also going to give another talk tomorrow, more about our merge strategy and how we're managing this large code base. I'm going to talk more about the technical details. But it was a pain because on top of 3.024, we had managed to add 35,000 lines of diff. And they were not really cleanly added. They were a little bit here, a little bit there, kind of a little bit like this. And so we had no defined patch stack. We had no easy way to grab new Samba code. And this became a major problem. So we fixed that with this latest merge. We split up into patches. And I'm going to talk about how we've abstracted that on a sort of per feature basis. Another thing we had, I'm sure lots of you are guilty of this as well. Customers got a problem, we got a fix, we had a new Samba parameter. We're never gonna give this stuff back, we don't have to worry about, you know, just tack on another parameter, give it a stupid name. Well, we had to go through the pain of upgrading all of these parameters to something useful when we pushed all of our code upstream into the main Samba repository. So I don't recommend that as a general rule. So here is the list of Windows-like features as well as additional benefits of 1FS that Samba is now taking advantage of as of 3.4. I'll kind of go through these. All of these are pretty much implemented inside the kernel, so the user space processes access them by making syscalls. That's a really nice, clean layer for us, and it turns out it makes it really easy to implement the usage of these inside Samba. So we have, we've got native NTFS, ACL, storage, and enforcement. Our inodes have NTFS security descriptors built into them. We support alternate data streams. We've got a zero copy read and write interface. Send file is already kind of a known postfixism. We made a function called receive file, so we could don't have to copy the file data up to user space from the socket and then back down into the kernel to get it to disk. It's just taken directly off the socket and put onto the disk. We have snapshots of the file system. And Windows has a volume shadow copy service, which allows the client to easily kind of roll back in time on specific files. So we had to make that work. We've got a bulk directory enumeration API called ReadDir Plus. This is basically an identical copy of the NFS v3 command ReadDir Plus, where you can get a large listing, 100 entries of a directory with stat information all in one single syscall instead of doing read dir stat over and over again. So that was a performance improvement for directory enumeration. I kind of broke these up. Though these are all on our cluster, the top ones are more stateful, are more built into the hard disk. And these bottom ones are more ephemeral. With the client connection, these exist. So it's important to note these are all cluster coherent. What we have is a create file syscall, like I mentioned, a very Windows-like API. It's a god-awful syscall. It has like 8 parameters, and if you do the permutations, it's over a million different ways you could call it. It's untestable, frankly, but this is what Windows does, so we implemented it because it's one way to get the atomic open and creating of a file the same way that a Windows system will. You acquire an op lock when you open the file, you acquire a share mode lock, you can set delete on close, you can actually set a security descriptor when you're creating the file in this singular call. So we've implemented that. We also have Windows byte range lock semantics. The Windows semantics for BRL are very different from POSIX BRL. Just a couple of things. They're mandatory instead of being optional. So reads and writes when there's a lock on that section of the file will fail. So we've implemented that. As well as POSIX byte range locks are, they're kind of at the per byte level. You can take a POSIX lock and then you can unlock it in chunks. You can't do that with Windows locks. They are an atomic unit. You have to specify the exact range on the unlock that you did on the lock. So we've got all those different semantics through what we have the IFS CBRL calls into our kernel. And we also have kernel-based change notification system. So you can watch a file, and if it's changed by any other client on any other node, the original watcher will be notified from the kernel. So these are all cluster coherent. You can take a byte range lock on any SMBD, on any node in the cluster, and every other client connection to any other node will contend on that lock. So these are the main things that I'm going to talk about how we implemented in Samba 3.4. Above all, the virtual file system is beautiful. It's what made our job so much easier during this merge and going forward. Samba has a virtual file system layer built in, Samba 3 we're talking about here, which is mostly a POSIX compatibility layer. So you can plug in the different Unix implementation of open and makedir and rename. But we expanded it a little bit it's kind of a merge between some Windows style APIs and some POSIX style APIs now. But it's a function dispatch table. The higher level protocol engine calls into these file system VOPs, and then you just plug in your function that you want to be called when that VOP is called. And so this is how we implemented most all of our syscall features in 3.4. So you build up a shared object. We built up a couple, but the main one is called 1fs.so. And here are the source code files you can look at right now. They're in the latest upstream. And for this, we define 31 different operations that our file system does differently from kind of standard POSIX. So the first one, to ease our way into it, was our access control lists. There's three main VOPs already defined in Samba. We have three main syscalls defined in IFS for getting and setting of security descriptors. The fget is with the fd, the get is with the file name. And so it was real simple. We just wrote a couple of our own functions in the 1fs module, 1fs fset ntacl, which calls into our IFS set security descriptor syscall. And that was it. It was a really straightforward, very mechanical process to make to call this functionality via the Samba VFS layer. A couple helper functions to kind of do the translation, because our ACL enums are a little different from Samba's ACL enums. But that was, it was really simple. And this was the very first feature I changed over, and I was happy that it was so clean. Volker.
I don't know, quick look, but do you have SIDs in the kernel?
No, we don't have SIDs in the kernel.
Okay, you do the mapping.
Yep, we do. We the files have UIDs and GIDs in the file system, and so we have a. Right. Yeah. Yeah. We have to translate UID to SID and back and forth mapping in user space. Next feature, byte range locks. It was almost identical to ACLs, three VFS calls, log, unlock, and cancel. The only difference is that these VFS calls didn't exist before we needed them. It was just there's one default implementation of byte range locks. So we took the model from ACLs, we wrote our own VOPs into the system. We took the code that was already there, and we made those the default implementation. So when no VFS module is loaded, that's what gets called automatically. When our VFS module is loaded, our ifs.cburl syscalls are called to grab locks from our kernel. So that was, and same, couple helper functions for translating, but really, really straightforward and easy. Change notify. Was brilliant. I'm so proud of how this is implemented in the current SMBD. It actually takes a single VFS call in order to set up a watch descriptor and do everything that you need for change notification. In the upper level of Samba and the protocol level, it's handled how to sort of aggregate notifications that you get from some system and send them back to the client. So all we had to do was define a single VFS notify watch VOP, which registers a watch request. What that does is actually makes a call into our kernel and sets up an event channel. We get a file descriptor back from our kernel level event channel. We register that with the main event loop in Samba 3.4. So we say, when this event gets read, here's a callback function I want you to call. That callback function is the kernel event handler. And so as soon as the kernel notices a change in the file, it lights up that FD. SMBD main loop notices it automatically. Didn't have to write any code in the main loop. Calls your callback function. We read off the event structure from that file descriptor. We convert it into a Windows-style notification. Hey, this file you want to watch, it just, the A time just got changed. Send that up to the Samba protocol layer, and it sends it out on the wire. And then there's a destructor attached to the talloc context, the memory context that we created up here in the watch, that when it's destroyed, we cleanly, Samba automatically cleanly shuts down, closes that FD, and so there's no resource leaks. So it's really, really simple to, if you've got the kernel change notify, to add in that ability into SMBD. Next, the open path. Like I said, we have this create file syscall in our system. And so we had to do a little code shifting around here. The open path in SMBD is probably the most complicated path that there is. Because without a single create file call, you can make them the kernel. You have to handle every one of those share mode lock acquisition and delete unclose and op lock, and you have to handle all that and just you know, pretty ginormous. It's not even one large function, it's several large functions. So we refactored that a little bit to put everything that could go under a create file into a VOP. This made the whole path a little bit cleaner, a little bit more broken down, and it made it easy for us to plug in our create file interface. So that's what we did. Again, just added a new VOP, restructured the code a little bit, and then plugged in our syscall. It's the recurring theme of my talk. So now I'm saying it's all super easy. I'll give you a little bit of the darker side or the disappointment. We had time constraints like everyone else. So a conversation about our bulk directory enumeration API came up. And my boss said, quote, "I want the Camry approach, not the Cadillac approach." Because if you don't know, SMB protocol, trans to find first, find next, is a bulk directory enumeration protocol. It wants a big chunk of data sent over the wire. And ReadDir Plus gives you a big chunk of data. And Samba uses the POSIX VFS API, which is ReadDir, stat, ReadDir, stat, ReadDir, stat. And so I really wanted to refactor the entire directory enumeration logic in Samba, add in these two new VFS layers, VFS calls, and stick that POSIX layer underneath it so that we'd get all the great efficiency of going from bulk enumeration API to bulk enumeration API and basically pull it from the kernel and put it on the wire with very little transition.
And some caching,
yep. I didn't have time to do that. So what I did instead was I just stuck our ReadDir Plus underneath of the POSIX VFS layer. So I grab a chunk and then I feed it up all in user space, all out of memory, so it's still there's still a performance gain to the higher level one at a time. With this, we saw just in sort of some rough tests about a 25% decrease in the latency of a normal find on a large directory. So there's a significant performance improvement grabbing all the stat information at once.
What's your fastest structure? Is your Rhino close to the directory entry, or does the disk have to just seek for every inode?
The directory structure is essentially a B-tree.
Yeah,
so
does it only contain names and the inode number, or does it actually contain the stat info in the directory itself? Like I understand NTFS or it's closer.
It does not contain in the directory entry itself. The stat information is still in the inode, so all the inodes have to be read to give back that. All the inodes have to be individually read to give back the stat information for each one. But that is another feature of our ReadDir Plus call, is that we prefetch inodes as part of the ReadDir Plus code. So we know if you're reading the first entry in the directory, you're probably going to want to read the next 10. And so it sends out requests to grab them. Because these inodes also in a clustered file system might live on another node. And so you really have a long delay waiting to read if you're just reading inodes without any read ahead or any pre-caching. So the Reader Plus API handles that a little bit by grabbing a lot in advance. OK. Oh, and the other mention, not on the slide, is if you think this POSIX interface is simple, you just open a directory, you kind of seek along a pointer, and then you return it back, like I did, it is amazingly complex how much trouble you can get in with these very simple set of rules. Yeah, because you have things like, you know, obviously, what happens if the directory contents change while you're reading them? So some reworking of this code was done several times by myself, learning these lessons the hard way. Okay, snapshots. Like I said, we've got directory level snapshots on our file system. Can be taken through our web interface. But Windows has the ability to have the client request specific file versions. It does this through this @gmt tag on the end of the file name with a specific date. So we because the shadow copy lookup essentially touches every operation that passes in a path. And the way that the virtual file system in Samba is structured, each module can only define a single definition for a VOP once. So this had to be put into a secondary module. You can link together the modules so they'll be called, a single VOP can be chained together, but inside of one single shared object, you can't define a VOP multiple times. So we have a second.so file, which handles our shadow copy, covers 41 VOPs, and essentially just does name translation. We get in the file with the GMT, we hack it off, we look in our special snapshots directory and pull the metadata to figure out the time, and then return that file to the client. The third shared object module we added through VFS was something brand new, something I'm hoping other people will take advantage of, which is a performance counter. There's a few auditing tools already in SMBD that tell you how many times of VFS calls were made. But we wanted to know, basically at the packet level, the same thing you'd get from a TCP dump. How many specific SMB packets are you getting? How many read requests? How many write requests? How many session setups? And so we implemented this in the higher levels of Samba. And effectively, where the data goes is what's implemented in the shared object. So with this performance counter in 3.4, we are able to count SMB packets by type, find out the maximum, minimum size, average size, as well as the latency, because we take a timestamp when we receive the packet, we take a timestamp when we send the reply back out, and then we can see how long the Samba server was actually sitting there generating that packet. We also calculate rates like the operations per second and the bytes per second bandwidth coming in and out of the server, and we can track on a per user basis to see who the hogs are on your system. So again, the framework for grabbing all this data exists in Samba right now. You have to write your own shared object module in order to output it somewhere useful. What we do is we have syscalls again that are made every time we want to record a piece of this performance data. And it's all that is sort of aggregated in kernel memory. And then it's retrieved through a command line program we've written called IzzyStatistics. We also wrote a perf count test module, which gives a template for how to do this yourself. It just dumps the data out to SMB log, but obviously anyone could write one to store to a SQL database, and then have another tool to actually pull that out and do some meaningful statistics and graphs and such with it. That's the perf count module estimate.conf parameter. And just a quick example, here's if you run our Izzy statistics tool, here's what the output looks like on our system. Walker?
Can I ask you for a favor?
Possibly.
All on the mailing lists who still use the old profile stuff, so that we might remove it. I mean, if nobody's using it, we could just remove it and have that module off the
internet. Now, are you referring to the audit or the?
No, this profile, star profile, and.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
It's very old SGI code.
Okay.
I mean, if nobody, after a week or so, or 2 weeks, or a month, responds, I'm using it, I need it.
Yeah,
I'll do that, because we're going to be maintaining this system going forward.
I mean, this has been orphaned for years.
Okay. Here's the output, broken down not by every SMB type, but kind of by buckets. As you see, for this particular workload, we had a whole bunch of query infos by path name and a lot of reads. Although these reads were tiny, the max output size on any read was 382 bytes. The metrics here are bytes and microseconds. So when you see latency average on the NT create, that's 1,081 microseconds or one millisecond. But this is very useful in our customers. We just tell them to run Izzy statistics, give it a 5-minute window when they're having seeing performance problems. One customer, it was incredibly obvious when their max out size over the course of 3 days was like 4K, that their application was being naughty and reading very, very small chunks, and that was the performance issue. Yeah, I'm not positive where we do the cutoff on the latency. It's probably just the initial request, the time it took us to reply to the initial request, not the actual watches. Okay, oplocks. This is another place hiding our dirty laundry. We didn't have time to make a oplocks VFS interface. One didn't exist. We didn't really have time to abstract it. So this is just a C file that's stuck into the main code, but at least it's abstracted out into its own file. The way oplocks work in our system, again, they're all implemented by the kernel. Calling create file, which Samba does now, will automatically grant an oplock by the kernel to the SMBD process. The SMBD process starts up a separate listening channel to receive events for oplock breaks from the kernel. Whenever a write occurs or there's some contention by another open file handle on that existing oplock, then a message is put on that FD for SMBD to read. SMBD process sees a break request, sends that to the client. Client sends back its cache data, and then SMBD notifies the kernel, OK, you can continue with the write. So there's a lot of communication up and down between user space and the client. That's all available through our kernel. So we formalize this all in the oplock1fs.c file. A couple other things that we added to more general Samba. Support for level 2 kernel oplocks wasn't there. Added spanning level 2 oplocks means before, when you wanted to hold, you wanted to break a level 2 oplock, we just had a single call, break level 2 oplock. But really, you need to have hold this break across the length of an operation, like a write. You don't want to just say break it at the beginning of the write and then have someone try to reacquire the oplock in the middle of the write. So we added in, broke it down to two calls, a start level 2 contention and end level 2 contention, so we can hold it across the entire operation, which is the more correct way of contending oplocks. And added a few flags for kernel oplock support, so the kernel can tell SMBD what it can do. And of course, all these things OneFS can do. Okay. There were a few things we couldn't fit in any kind of modular way. One specific one is files on our system are uniquely identified by a device ID, an inode, and then a snapshot ID, because we can have multiple snapshots of the same file. So we added in this extended ID, which we use for snapshots in Samba, and ideally will be generic enough for other file systems to use if they need an additional identifier to unicify their files as well. So we had to add this. This was a bit intrusive because file ID is all of the code, so we had to add this to the struct and check it in a lot of different code paths. Other smaller additions, miscellaneous stuff we kind of did during this whole process of upstreaming all our code. We had lots of SMB torture tests that we put in because we were always, you know, testing little corner cases that weren't tested yet. And so those got pushed upstream. The ShareSec utility, which is a command line utility to edit shared share level ACLs, flesh that out a little bit more. It had been kind of orphaned. Added a feature that our customers use called access-based share enumeration. Samba already has the ability to not show you files if you don't have read access to them. This is that same applied to shares, not even broadcast the shares available if you don't have share level read access to it. So we added that feature. We had a bunch of Coverity fixes. We run Coverity all the time. We pushed them up. Backtrace symbols for FreeBSD when we core, makes it a lot easier to debug. Allow setting of create time via some SMBDs. The set adder allows you to set create time, and so we kind of plumbed that through. And then in refactoring, there was just a lot of helper functions we pulled out and added. So that's just all smaller stuff. Jerry?
Hey, so on the share-based filtering, how do you deal with machine accounts when the machine uses its own credentials in the session setup for like browsing for DFS? I mean, when you don't have the user's credentials, does that screw up filtering for you?
I am not really familiar with the implementation of the access that share based. So, yeah, we can talk about it after and check out the code. Yes?
So, in Jonathan, if last time you say you use the same UID, GID principles as Unix does, regular Unix systems?
Yes.
So, how do you start the file that's owned by groups in Windows?
That's a good question, because we had that conversation earlier. I'm not sure off the top of my head. Yeah, we can take that offline too, because the good point, if you're mapping the okay, the group SID should be mapped to a GID from the range.
SID, the owner SID is just a SID. SID can be like administrators. So if the owner SID is supposed to map to an owner, but it's actually a Windows group, and that's the problem. Does that make sense? I mean, what do you do when administrators own a file?
Yeah, I think we might store whether that UID is a group or a user in the inode. I think that might be what we do, just based off our LS output, so we know, even though it's just a SID or an integer, whether it represents a group or a user, we store that information along with it. Actually in the ACE, but.
You'll get a clash between GIDs and UID, because somebody will think that this is UID from Unix. If somebody looks at this file as a Unix user, he will see this UID, he will see the GID as a ID. So in your kernel knows that this is actually a GID.
Right, but if you're using the tools, I mean our command line tools to like do an LS of the ACL and print it out, then it'll say.
How do you present that to NFS clients?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Good answer.
Yes, good question. I'll look into it.
You could be turned
nobody is the owner, and then a group ID by the best part. Just map that user to their own ID.
Just give nobody no permissions.
Yeah. That might work.
So, conclusion. Lots of modularity in Samba. Definitely take advantage of it. It's made our lives as developers so much easier. It's very easy to add OS-specific features through the VFS. And I was constantly pleasantly surprised how easy it was to actually abstract our specific features, because we basically rewrote those 35,000 lines of code. Push as much of your work upstream as possible. It works for us. A lot less merge headache, better overall compilation and testing by more people. Tim will go into a lot more of these benefits in his talk tomorrow. And then through just a thorough code audit of understanding what the system did before tacking on, we found lots of little, you know, neat warts and bugs and things that didn't work at all. So that was useful for the entire code base as well. That's it. Questions?
Just a comment. I mean, one thing, you started out with the VFS being this, you described the VFS as being a POSIX layer, POSIX level thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems that we gradually move to the NTFS semantics. I mean, create file is the one. Find next.
It's something I thought about discussing. I didn't really put it in here, but it seems like the NTFS, at least for us, the NTFS VFS layer is a better abstraction. And so we kind of have this hodgepodge of both and even calls that don't really belong to either right now in the VOP. And I definitely think it's a good project of kind of stating what's going to be more rigid restrictions for the VFS layer and cleaning it up a bit. But that's kind of a open discussion for sure.
If I understand correctly, this is the state of VFS layer in Samba 4.
No. This is also
Samba 3.
No, but I understand that in Samba 4 they move completely. VFS layer almost completely represents the VFS views.
Yes.
Here we have some kind of in the middle, we have some function.
I mean, there are problems with it. You have parameters like the veto files, I think, you know, where you're checking a file name and saying, no, we don't return it. And it's so much nicer to have that at the very top layer, so you only have to check once. If you put a trans2 find first VFS call, then every single implementation has to make sure it checks every one of these parameters in its own way, and that's a lot of code duplication.
One thing that you have the empty echo calls,
mm-hmm.
and then we have a default implementation that gets back to the VFS again that does the POSIX level echo calls,
mm-hmm.
Jeremy's famous POSIX echo.c.
Yep.
And so we have these two layers inside a single VFS, and we might do some work in the future to separate those out of it. Or I mean, just mark them as comments. Oh, this is an NTFS call, and we have this default implementation going back to the POSIX call there.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. Document that a bit better.
Agree. There's more documentation and cleanup and defined rules for the VOP layer that can be done.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.